All right, so let's dive into something kind of fascinating today. The story of what happened after the Brown v. Board of Education decision. I mean, you probably already know the basics, right? 1954, Supreme Court, declared segregated schools unconstitutional. Huge moment. But our deep dive today uses Brown II, the very next year, where the court laid out how this was actually supposed to happen across the nation.
Yeah.
Trust me, going through this document, it's not just dry legal stuff. There are some head-scratching parts that make you go, "Wait, really? They did that?"
You're spot on. The court knew that just saying segregation is illegal wouldn't change things overnight, right? Brown II was their attempt to kind of create a roadmap for how this is going to actually work. But what's striking is how they went about it.
Okay, so the document itself, it explicitly references those earlier Brown rulings, almost like it's saying, "Remember all that? We meant it. Now here's how we make it real."
Right, it's building on those principles, but shifting gears from the what to the how. And that's where things get interesting. The court actually invited the U.S. Attorney General and the attorneys general from individual states to give their input.
Hold on. They asked the states for their opinions. But some of these states were fighting desegregation tooth and nail.
Precisely. It highlights how the court was trying to balance two things. On one hand, they're the highest legal authority, they've made a ruling. But on the other hand, they recognized that desegregation would look very different in Mississippi than, say, in Kansas. They couldn't just issue a blanket order from on high and expect it to work everywhere.
Yeah, I'm already seeing how complex this gets. And the document even acknowledges this directly. They use the phrase varied local school problems. It's almost like they're anticipating the chaos.
Absolutely. They knew this wasn't just about moving kids around. Think about it. To make desegregation work, you might need to build new schools, redraw district lines, figure out transportation for students in rural areas. It's a massive undertaking.
So the court, by saying varied local problems, is basically admitting this is going to be a logistical nightmare. But did they just dump all this on local school boards and say, "Good luck"?
Not quite. While they gave primary responsibility to local authorities, the court held on to the power to review whether those actions were made in good faith. Think of it like the court was the referee making sure everyone was playing by the rules, even if they couldn't dictate every move on the field.
Okay, so that's how they kept some control over the process. But what about the timeline? Everyone's waiting to see these changes. How long did schools have?
And here's where we get to that infamous phrase, all deliberate speed. The court mandates desegregation starts immediately, but the pace, well, that's where the deliberate comes in. And let me tell you, that word has caused endless debate ever since.
I can imagine. Deliberate is pretty subjective. Did some places use that as an excuse to delay things as long as possible?
It's a valid question. Was the court being shrewd, knowing they couldn't force rapid change everywhere, or did deliberate speed become a loophole for those resisting desegregation? It's something historians still argue about.
Wow. So even in this document meant to clarify things, there's already this built-in tension between making change happen and the reality of how messy that change was going to be.
Exactly.
Hmm.
And to understand the impact, we need to look beyond the legalese and consider the human side of things. Imagine being a black family in the South in 1955. The court says separate but equal is over, but what does all deliberate speed really mean for your child's education?
It must have felt like a victory, but also a frustratingly vague one. Like, how long do you wait for the promise of equality to actually become a reality?
And here's where Brown II makes a crucial shift. It changes the burden of proof. Before, black families had to prove they were being harmed by segregation. Brown II flips that it's on the schools to justify any delays, not on the families to keep fighting for access.
Okay, so that puts the pressure on the ones dragging their feet. It's saying, "We've decided segregation is wrong. Now you have to convince us why any more delay is acceptable."
Precisely. And to guide the lower courts who'd be hearing these arguments, Brown II outlined specific areas they could consider. Things like the physical condition of schools, transportation systems, personnel, even local laws that might be in the way.
It's like they're acknowledging that segregation wasn't just about separate buildings. It was woven into every part of the system.
Absolutely. And the fact they explicitly mentioned things like local laws shows they knew some states would try to use existing segregationist laws to slow down the process. This wasn't naive idealism, it was a strategic attempt to anticipate the pushback they knew was coming.
This is getting really interesting.
Yeah.
So even though this Brown II document is about the nuts and bolts of implementation, it's actually revealing a lot about the political realities of the time.
It is, and it sets the stage for what's to come. Years of legal battles, civil rights activism, and a constant struggle to turn the promise of Brown v. Board into a reality. But that, as they say, is a story for another deep dive.
Right. But before we go down that rabbit hole, let's pause here.
Yeah.
We've covered a lot of ground already, and I think it's worth taking a moment to let this all sink in. What are your initial thoughts?
Well, what's striking to me is that even though Brown II was meant to bring clarity, it also introduced a lot of ambiguity. This idea of all deliberate speed is a perfect example. It acknowledges the need for flexibility, but also opens the door for potential abuse and delay tactics.
That's a great point. And it makes me think about the human cost of those delays. We're talking about real children whose lives were directly impacted by how quickly or slowly their communities embraced desegregation.
It's a sobering thought, and it reminds us that legal victories, while important, are just the beginning of a much longer and more complex journey toward true equality.
I completely agree. And I'm really curious to explore that journey further in our next deep dive. But for now, let's leave our listeners with this. We've seen how Brown II attempted to translate a monumental legal principle into action. It's a fascinating case study in the challenges of implementing sweeping social change. And it raises some tough questions about the balance between speed strategy and the very real human consequences of waiting for justice.
Yeah, it really does make you think about those families and communities caught in the middle of this massive shift. And it brings us back to that phrase we keep coming back to, all deliberate speed. What does that even mean in practical terms?
Right, it's such a loaded phrase. On the one hand, it seems like the court is recognizing that you can't just flip a switch and change everything overnight. But on the other hand, deliberate can also mean slow, you know, hesitant, even reluctant. And when it comes to basic rights, any delay feels like an injustice.
It's a tricky balance. And honestly, looking back, all deliberate speed might be the most controversial part of this entire Brown II decision. It raises so many questions that are still relevant today.
Like, what's the right balance between pushing for immediate change and understanding that complex problems take time to solve, and who gets to decide what deliberate actually means?
Exactly. And when we're talking about something as fundamental as education, those delays have real consequences. Imagine being a student, knowing you've been denied equal opportunities, and then being told to wait at a deliberate pace.
Yeah, it's hard to even fathom the frustration and disappointment that must have caused. But this document wasn't just about timelines. It also went into specific areas the lower courts should consider when evaluating desegregation plans.
Yes, and that's where the court's attempt to grapple with the complexity of this issue becomes even more apparent. They list things like the physical condition of school buildings, transportation systems, the availability of qualified teachers, and even the potential need to redraw district lines.
It's almost like they're creating a checklist for dismantling segregation. Like, okay, have you addressed this? What about this? And what about this over here? It really highlights how deeply entrenched segregation was in every facet of the education system.
Absolutely. The court recognized that desegregation wasn't just about changing laws. It was about dismantling a whole system built on the premise of separation and inequality.
And it wasn't just about the physical infrastructure either. They also mentioned the need to consider personnel. What does that even mean in this context?
Well, think about the teachers and administrators who had spent their entire careers working within a segregated system. Some may have held deeply ingrained prejudices, while others may have simply lacked the experience or training to navigate a newly integrated environment.
That's a really good point. Desegregation wasn't just about moving students around. It was about changing the entire culture of education. It required a massive shift in mindsets and practices.
Exactly. And the court recognized that this wouldn't happen overnight. They knew that there would be resistance, both overt and subtle, and that desegregation would require ongoing effort, oversight, and a willingness to adapt to new challenges.
It's fascinating how this seemingly straightforward goal, ending segregation in schools, quickly becomes this tangled web of logistical, social, and even psychological complexities.
And it's a reminder that progress rarely follows a straight line. There will always be setbacks, unforeseen obstacles, and moments where it feels like the pace of change is agonizingly slow.
Which brings us back to that question of all deliberate speed. Was this phrase a necessary acknowledgement of the complexities involved, or did it ultimately give cover to those who wanted to delay justice? It's a question that continues to resonate today.
It absolutely does. And it's a question that's relevant to any movement for social change. How do we balance the urgency of the cause with the reality that deep-seated problems often require time and sustained effort to address?
It's a dilemma that I think we're still grappling with today. But for now, let's shift gears a bit and consider the impact of Brown II from a different angle. The document spends a lot of time outlining the responsibilities of schools and courts. But what about the role of individuals and communities?
That's a great question, because ultimately desegregation wasn't just a legal process, it was a social and cultural transformation. And that transformation relied heavily on the courage, resilience, and activism of countless individuals who refused to accept the status quo.
I'm thinking about the parents who fought tirelessly to ensure their children had access to quality education, the students who bravely integrated all-white schools, the civil rights leaders who organized protests and marches.
And the countless everyday citizens who, through their actions big and small, chipped away at the walls of segregation. Their stories are an integral part of the Brown v. Board legacy.
Absolutely. And while we can't possibly do justice to all those stories in a single deep dive, it's important to remember that legal victories don't happen in a vacuum. They're fueled by the collective efforts of people who demand change, who challenge injustice, and who refuse to be silenced.
Well said. And their stories remind us that the fight for equality is an ongoing process, a relay race where each generation passes the torch to the next.
I love that analogy, the relay race of progress. It perfectly captures the idea that social change is a marathon, not a sprint. And speaking of marathons, I think we've covered a lot of ground in this deep dive. We've explored the complexities of Brown II, from its attempts to balance federal authority with local realities, to its controversial use of all deliberate speed. We've considered the human cost of delays and the crucial role of individual activism in driving change.
And we've barely scratched the surface of the long and arduous journey toward true educational equality. But that's the beauty of a deep dive, isn't it? It's about sparking curiosity, exploring new perspectives, and leaving our listeners with more questions than answers.
You said it. Yeah. And on that note, I think it's time to wrap things up. But before we do, I want to leave our listener with one final thought. We've talked about the legal framework, the challenges, even the frustrating ambiguity of all deliberate speed. But I'm curious, looking back at Brown II now, what stands out to you as the most significant aspect of this document?
That's a great question. I think for me, what's most remarkable about Brown II is how it tries to strike this delicate balance. You know, on the one hand, the court is acknowledging the deeply ingrained nature of segregation, the fact that it's woven into the very fabric of society. That's why they give local authorities so much leeway in figuring out the how of desegregation.
Right. They knew a one-size-fits-all approach wouldn't work.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they didn't just wash their hands of it and say, figure it out yourselves.
Exactly. They built in mechanisms for oversight. They shifted the burden of proof onto the schools, and they made it clear that all deliberate speed didn't mean indefinite delay. It's like they were trying to thread this needle between respecting the complexities on the ground and maintaining the pressure for real, tangible change.
It makes you wonder what would happen if they'd taken a more forceful approach. Like if they'd said, desegregate now, no excuses.
Oh, that's a fascinating hypothetical. It's possible that a more aggressive stance would have led to faster initial progress. But it also could have triggered even more resistance, more legal challenges, maybe even violence. We can't know for sure. But Brown II reflects this awareness that the court could issue rulings, but they couldn't single-handedly change hearts and minds overnight.
It's almost like they understood the limits of their own power. Like they could declare segregation unconstitutional, but actually making it happen in every school and every community, that was going to require a much broader societal shift.
And that's a really important point, because Brown II ultimately set the stage not just for legal battles, but for the civil rights movement as a whole. It energized activists, it galvanized communities, it forced the nation to confront the deeply rooted injustices of segregation.
So in a way, Brown II wasn't just a legal document, it was a catalyst. It sparked a movement that went far beyond the courtroom.
Precisely. And that's why, even though it's often overshadowed by the landmark Brown v. Board ruling, Brown II deserves our attention. It's a fascinating glimpse into the messy, complex process of turning legal principles into lived reality.
I totally agree. And it reminds us that progress is rarely neat or predictable.
Right.
Right? It's full of twists and turns, compromises and setbacks. But even in a document as dense and technical as Brown II, we can see the seeds of that progress being planted.
And that's a powerful thought to leave our listener with, because the story of Brown v. Board isn't just history, it's an ongoing narrative. The fight for educational equality continues, and the lessons we learn from Brown II about the importance of strategy persistence and understanding the complexities of social change, those are just as relevant today as they were back in 1955.
Well said. And on that note, I think we've reached the end of our deep dive. I hope you've enjoyed this exploration of Brown II and all its surprising twists and turns. It's been a fascinating journey, and it's left me with a lot to think about.
It's been my pleasure as well, and I hope it's inspired our listener to keep digging deeper, keep questioning, and keep engaging with these complex but essential conversations.
Until next time, keep those minds curious and those deep dives coming.